Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
Stop! Hammer time.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com for comprehensive show notes, Cosby Show highlight videos, book suggestions, or to just leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. And here's Bert.
Hey, everybody. This is Brett, and today is June 11th. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. This is part two in our series, Adverse Childhood Experiences and Resilience. Before we get to all that, I was saying a few shows ago that May was a bit of a tough month. Well, let me tell you, June is a goddamn home run so far, like a home run derby. I have a handful, actually more than a handful, maybe like three handfuls of people that I want to thank before we get into today's show. So we're going to start with Harold O. He's from Maryland. He recently purchased for us off our Amazon wish list the Logitech 920 HD webcam. This is the best webcam I know of. I have a 910. That thing is great. The 920 is 10 more than that, so it's got to be phenomenal. And that's really going to help the appearance of our streaming video show. Details to come on that. We're getting close. And this is actually the second item Harold purchased for us off the old list. He also got us a beautiful 24-inch Asus monitor that I'm staring at right now. It is a beauty. And Harold might even add more value to the show in the future by appearing on it some point down the road to talk about sleep, specifically biphasic sleep. But I would be willing to do a whole series on sleep. You know, it is one third of life, or in my case, one fourth of life, but I'm working on that. I also want to thank Greta from Bellevue, Washington, and Sarah from Chicago for their increased donations. Thank you. Sarah, by the way, AV Club member number 9. So, Sarah, I'm really happy you're still finding so much value in the show. And then Jahida and Max for their recent donations on Venmo. Hey, if you want to do like a one-time thing, check out Venmo. There's no fees. Jahida was the one who first told me about that maybe a year ago. And she has continued to be so generous, and it is greatly appreciated. And also, I want to thank David S., and there's a story that goes with this one. So last week, I had an opportunity to go and meet up with some old college friends and maybe even some old work friends from that boarding school that I used to work at back in the day. It's all in the same general area, North Adams, Massachusetts, Williamstown, Massachusetts, Bennington, Vermont. Beautiful, scenic. But I was going to need to be there for a couple of days, and I needed to get a hotel. And I said to myself, you know, what kind of caviar-eating, ascot-wearing one-percenter can just go and stay in a hotel? Well, turns out I can, because travel sites like Expedia now take Bitcoin, and I still have some of those. So I spent 0.8 Bitcoin for two nights in a hotel in the Berkshire Mountains. Very relaxing. R&R is important. I get back to New Hampshire only to find that David S. had dropped a one Bitcoin donation into my wallet. So that was just an amazing feeling. It was like getting a free hotel. So thank you so much. So I just want to thank the new subscribers that came in this month really quickly. You have all been added to the queue for our new subscriber geography trivia, which will return soon, I promise. Tony from York, Pennsylvania. That's Tony Myers, by the way. An asset to the show anyway. Frederick C. from Worcester, Ohio. Michal from the Czech Republic. Curtis N. I need to know where you live, Curtis. Lance D. from Grandview, Iowa. Daniel C. from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Bruce D. from Littleton, Colorado. Brandon A. from Houston, Texas. Miriam S. from Nottingham, Maryland. Ellen L. from Santa Clarita, California. Ruben Z. from De Demsvaart in the Netherlands, and Joseph F. from Bellingham, Washington. Thank you all. And like I said, I was really nervous last month, but things are much better now. I can feel the ants migrating out of my pants, and that's really helpful. So if you are a subscriber, if you do have access to the AV Club, I want to tell you, I was really motivated by this bump we got in the first couple weeks of June, so I've added a bunch of stuff. And one thing that I would recommend is the recent discussion about the whole nonviolent communication conflict that happened in our Facebook group. Daryl Becker, Tony Myers, and I spent a little over 70 minutes doing an initial discussion. We are planning a production in July, but this was more of an opportunity to vent some of the frustration we were feeling. We don't want that to come through in the production. We want to shoot for balance there. So this was more of an airing of grievances and what we thought of what happened and how we can go about planning a production. Highly recommended. I'm sorry, my audio is not good. I was on a headset mic because I wanted to pace around. But I won't do that again. Sometimes you just have to sit. Sitting is a part of life. What's going to happen today is we're going to go through ACES questions 1 through 4, score ourselves. That's going to lead to some discussion. In the third session, we'll do questions 5 through 10. And we are going to start again today with a video from internal family systems therapist Pete Gerlach. I link to his YouTube channel in the show notes. His last name is spelled G-E-R-L-A-C-H. And his site is sfhelp.org if you're interested in checking his work out. Also recommended the Complete Liberty series on trauma, episodes 209, 210, 211, and 212. And that Complete Liberty episode 212, one of the best episodes of any podcast that I've ever heard. And you're in luck because the two guys on that show are the same two guys on this show you're about to hear. Stay tuned after our discussion. I'm going to add another excerpt from The Body Keeps the Score. These clips were chosen as reinforcements for our discussion. I want to thank everybody for their positive feedback on the first episode in this series. Looks like it's going to be a four-parter when everything is said and done. So let's get to it. This is part two. Thanks for listening, everybody. Take care.
Hi, I'm Pete Gerlach. I am a veteran family systems therapist, and I've created a website, a nonprofit educational website, with 8 self-improvement lessons. One of the self-improvement topics that I present has to do with parenting. My observation over 3 decades as a therapist and 7 decades on Earth is that a high percentage of average parents, without meaning to, traumatize and psychologically wound their children. These kids, unless somebody intervenes, grow up and they repeat that with their own children. So I want to expose some information here in this brief summary video on parents traumatizing children. An unspoken question here is, could you have been traumatized by your well-meaning adults? I hope this will give you some insight. Let me start by defining what is childhood trauma. What is that? I'm going to define that as some kind of environmental process or an event that causes significant psychological damage, injury, or wounds to a young, developing child. That can be a physical trauma, like a hurricane, or it can be subtle emotional trauma from parents. I'm going to focus on the latter. I propose that there are 3 generic, widespread types of early childhood trauma that many people are unaware of or deny. See if these sound familiar to you. One is parental neglect, one is parental abandonment, and the last is parental abuse, child abuse. Let's take a quick look at each one of those. Child neglect occurs when the adults responsible for raising a young, vulnerable child don't know what the child needs, and or they don't know how to fill the needs, and or they don't want to fill the needs, and they don't. That's my definition of child neglect. See how it compares to your definition. Child abandonment is a paradox because it can occur even though a child is raised for 20-some years in the presence of one or more biological parents or surrogate parents, step-parents, foster parents, even though they are living with some supervising adults, young children can still be neglected and abandoned. How does that happen? If their supervising adults either spend little time with a young child, or if they do spend time with the child, but the adults are emotionally unavailable, which incidentally is a sign of an inherited psychological wound. You may know adults, parents, who are unable to empathize and really love, genuinely feel and give love and affection and attention. So a form of child abandonment, parental abandonment, occurs if their supervising adults are emotionally unavailable, meaning they are psychologically wounded and can't bond or empathize or exchange love. This can occur, abandonment can occur in a family where both parents are working and the child is often left alone, or an older child is left to supervise a younger child. It often occurs with divorced parents where a child gets limited or no contact with one of their own parents. These are epidemic in our country. Almost half of American families, most of whom have young children, or some children, are divorced. The third of three traumatizers I want to cover briefly here is child abuse. That's a very complex subject. I'm only going to highlight a couple of points about it. Abuse occurs with adults or kids if somebody is dependent on another person. Person B depends on person A for something vital. Person A uses person B to gratify their own needs in a way that harms person B. And person B cannot protect themselves or leave. When those three conditions are true, true abuse occurs. Children, by definition, can't take care of themselves, they can't flee, and if their adults use them as spies or surrogate partners, either socially or sexually, that is true abuse. It is a major form of child trauma, especially if it occurs early in a child's developmental years. So child neglect, child abandonment, and child abuse are three, in my judgment, epidemic family dynamics that are crippling many, if not most, American families, perhaps in other countries as well. What happens to kids who are traumatized by some combination of these? In my judgment, as a professional therapist, typical kids, young kids, who are not aware that this is happening, automatically develop up to six specific psychological wounds. A fragmented personality, excessive shame, excessive guilt, excessive fears, excessive reality distortions like denial or projection, problems learning who to trust, distrusting themselves, trusting other people too much. And if young kids have all five of those wounds, I lump shame and guilt together, they often then inherit the wound of being unable to bond. They can't feel their feelings. They don't know what they are. They're empty. They can't love. They can't connect emotionally, spiritually with other human beings. And because our society frowns on that, they have to learn to pretend that they can bond when in fact they really can't. Those six wounds accrue to children who are unintentionally traumatized by wounded parents who themselves were traumatized as young children. A fact worth noting here is kids who have been traumatized don't know it. Trauma is what they see as normal. So when such adults, as they start to experience these symptoms, depression, divorce, obesity, problems with money, listlessness, apathy, lack of direction, if someone says, "How was your childhood?" they say, "Oh, it's fine." They don't know it was not fine until, usually in midlife after hitting bottom and gaining a lot of life experience, they look backwards and they say, "Oh my gosh, my family was really dysfunctional. I did not get my needs met. I was traumatized." That doesn't happen often until midlife or later. Symptoms of kids before midlife who have been traumatized and wounded are widespread and well known. Kids, quote, acting out at home, being disobedient or angry or dishonest. Kids who have substantial school problems, social problems, health problems. These are broad-based symptoms that often, not always, often indicate they have been traumatized in their early years. The kids are not the problem, the parents are. A wide number of well-meaning, uneducated, unaware, psychologically wounded parents unintentionally traumatize their young children, pass on psychological wounds and ignorance, and continue the cycle of toxic inheritance. I hope you'll find this thought-provoking, and more than that, I hope it will motivate you to check yourself.
So before we actually get into the questions for the adverse childhood experiences, I thought I would just go through the research article, then we'll move on from there. So we already talked about some of this, but the background was the relationship of health risk behavior in disease in adulthood to the breadth of exposure to childhood emotional, physical, or sexual abuse and household dysfunction during childhood had not previously been described. So when this was recently, right? This was like 10 years ago that this was first developed?
I want to say 96.
Oh, 20 years ago?
Yeah, 97.
All right. Well, that's fine. I'll jump to the Wikipedia article. Yep, 95 to 97. Adverse Childhood Experiences Study is a research study conducted by Kaiser Permanente Health Maintenance Organization and the CDC. Participants were recruited to the study between 1995 and 1997 and had been in long-term follow-up for health outcomes. The study has demonstrated an association of adverse childhood experiences with health and social problems as an adult. The study has been analyzed extensively, is frequently cited as a notable landmark in epidemiological research, and has produced more than 50 scientific articles in more than 100 conference and workshop presentations that look at the prevalence and consequences of ACEs. The methods: a questionnaire about adverse childhood experiences was mailed to 13,494 adults who had completed a standardized medical evaluation at a large HMO. 9,000, listen, this is amazing. As a marketer, this is these numbers.
What's your open rate?
The last thing we tested, 3 in 26.
And what did they get here?
9,508. To simplify, 9 out of 13, or 70%, completed and sent back the test, which is absolutely amazing. 7 categories of adverse childhood experiences were studied: psychological, physical, or sexual abuse, violence against mother or living with household members who were substance abusers, mentally ill or suicidal, or ever imprisoned. The number of categories of these adverse childhood experiences was then compared to measures of adult risk behavior, health status, and disease. Logistic regression was used to adjust for effects of demographic factors on the association between the cumulative number of categories of childhood exposures, ranging from 0 to 7, and risk factors for the leading causes of death in adult life. Anything to add?
Well, in the bottom there, they list the medical subject headings: child abuse, sexual domestic violence, spouse abuse, children of impaired parents, substance abuse, alcoholism, smoking, obesity, physical activity, depression, suicide, sexual behavior, sexually transmitted diseases, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and ischemic heart disease. So that's kind of like the tag words for all this stuff and what it can lead to, you know, the physical and the mental, basically.
Or can you think of any tags that are missing?
No, it seems to be pretty comprehensive. I think addictions in general, you know, whether it's to some substance, alcohol or other drugs, or to different things like, say, shopping or reality TV or who knows what, to sort of distract oneself from the discomfort, once again, that one feels as a result of experiences that were not life enriching early on.
Yeah.
So what does one do with those experiences? That's kind of the thing for humans to grapple with, right?
Mm.
Like if you had all these experiences that were not esteeming of yourself, then what do you do with them? And I think naturally people tend to find ways to dissociate from them and to self-medicate.
Sure. So I guess the next step would be to find out, you know, if people are new to this, if they've had them or not, mm-hmm. which we, the three of us, are going to model the best we can in this discussion as we go through the questions.
Yeah, there's just 10 of them. So it's pretty easy to go through in just a matter of a minute or two to find out what your A score is.
Yeah, it is. But then I think, like I said before, trying to expand it, because there are certainly the possibility that people had traumatic experiences that are entirely missing from this.
Yeah.
You know, like there is no question on here, did you ever witness your parents fighting? But you and I both witnessed plenty of that growing up. You know, your parents got divorced when you were 7.
Yes.
My parents got divorced when I was 21.
Yeah, and so the ACE is for people, you know, what happened in your childhood and adolescence. So up to age 18,
mm-hmm.
but what happens if something dramatic happens in your 20s?
Yeah.
For example, what happened with Matt? You know, he shared that on our show.
Yeah.
Dad
yeah.
committed suicide. Mm. So that I would consider a huge adverse experience. Mm. And on this other page, the acestoohigh.com site about the resilience aspect, they say there are, of course, many other types of childhood trauma. Watching a sibling being abused, losing a caregiver, grandmother, mother, grandfather, etc. I mean, I think most kids end up losing a grandfather or grandmother at some point.
Yeah.
Or great, you know. Homelessness, surviving and recovering from a severe accident. Mm. Witnessing a father being abused by a mother. Witnessing a grandmother abusing a father, etc. They study included only those 10 childhood traumas because those were mentioned as most common by a group of about 300 Kaiser members. Those traumas were also well studied individually in the research literature. So,
yeah. It's hard to believe with such a high divorce rate that parents being, you know, a witness to parents fighting, especially as a young child, which can be a really terrifying thing, wouldn't have made the list. And I almost wonder if it was avoided for some reason, you know, and just or divorce. Does the word divorce appear on there?
Yes.
I don't remember.
That's an ACE.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I figured it had to be.
So yeah, you could have a situation where a couple is together and they're having a pretty functional relationship and relating to each other in respectful ways.
Yeah.
But decide that it's best in terms of pursuing their what they really want in life to separate, to divorce. And that qualifies as an ACE. However, what about a couple that stays together and fights all the time? Like argues, essentially.
With stays raised, together for the children.
Raised yeah. voices, yeah. you know? That doesn't qualify as an ACE?
Like, no. Yeah.
It seems to be leaving out a lot. But again, this is the first steps into this realm that the mainstream is doing. And I think that for them to take a giant leap to where we're considering things is not psychologically realistic.
Right.
You know?
And that was why I suggested supplementing with some selections from the questions from Breaking Free or some of the exercises in the Art of Self-Discovery, which we can also do after we go through this. So are we ready?
We've been recording, haven't we?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I mean, are
Good.
We ready for the next? Oh, you know, while we're having just a pause right here, we should welcome. Should we welcome our?
Absolutely.
We do have some guests.
And I did. Peanut gallery here, right?
Studio audience.
I did put.
No peanuts.
Mike's, well, peanuts aren't good for you, and I have
aflatoxins. You've been listening to Dave Asprey too much? What's going on?
You know, that's true. I can't just listen.
And they're
to
not that. Actually a nut, are they?
No, they're a legume. So we have Stephanie Murphy and Brian Sovereign in the studio. And
Hi.
You want to just say hello?
Hi. Nice to be here. Thanks for having us in the beautiful new School Sucks studio.
School Sucks. Yes. Hello. It's wonderful to see the show live for the first time.
Oh, great. The mic is there in case they want to chime in, which unfortunately I hate to say, but we have to do by you raising your hand.
Oh.
You don't have any fruit to throw out?
Only blueberries, and I don't even
peanuts?
Think we would notice. So here we are, finding your ACE score. And this, again, applies to when you were growing up, the first 18 years of life. Question number one, did a parent or other adult in the household often or very often swear at you, insult you, put you down, or humiliate you? Or the second part of that, act in a way that made you afraid you might be physically hurt?
And this is a yes or no, and if you have a yes, you put a one there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And given the statistics out there about corporal punishment or spanking, a.k.a. hitting children, you would think everyone would get a one there, or at least over 90% of the population would.
Yeah.
Because being physically hurt, I guess maybe the mainstream would consider spanking not physically hurting the child, but I think that's the intention, to induce fear of being hurt.
And they say often... Or very often, I'm sorry if I'm a child and I get hit once.
Yeah.
I'm changed. But again, this is their attempt at it to,
yeah.
you know, not go too far, but get, you know, a question down that, you know, people could differentiate between getting hit a lot and getting hit maybe just once in a while, which would be 90% getting hit once in a while, right?
Yeah. at least. And then, you know, the insults, the put downs, humiliation, even occasionally, that's traumatic for children.
So I took a one for that one based on, you know, put downs, or kind of being scolded in a way, or told that I was functionally illiterate was a phrase I remember hearing. Gosh. Like I wasn't able to do things that I should be able to do at my age.
They said functionally illiterate to you?
I remember being called that because I was like, what does that mean? Ugh. I don't know what either of those
words
mean.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that's brutal.
So there was not a lot of spanking in my when I was a kid, but I was spanked, and I did witness my youngest brother being spanked more regularly than I was. You know, I thought about that one a lot, but I took a one personally.
Yeah, I probably have a one, although I don't recall being humiliated. My uncle told me that my father would do those tactics when I was a toddler.
Yeah.
So I don't really have memories of it, but I think it contributed to my sense of fearfulness and shyness around others.
Yeah.
You know, not feeling safe, not feeling respected or understood, those kinds of things.
Matt?
And, you know, in Brandon's work, he talks about sarcasm. That's not specifically stated here. There was a lot of sarcastic kind of put-downs, but it was difficult to understand. So I can't really put a one on there for that, but definitely in the sarcasm and, you know, kind of jokes that might have a couple meanings.
Yeah.
That was pretty prevalent in my house.
You know, another thing you mentioned before the show, where you talked about, you know, kind of having a bit of a conflict with somebody who came from a very different background, which was more of like a misunderstanding. I remember bringing somebody from the South who was raised in a very polite Southern family to see my family for the first or second time, a bunch of Italians from East Boston. And this person said to me, the tones of voice that are used are like really intense and kind of scary. Everyone always seems like they're angry at each other. And I was like, I've never even thought about that in my entire life, you know, and then started paying attention. Or I've listened to maybe tones of voice used by parents. I mean, I still have relationships with both my parents, and I've actually spoken to them even recently about a lot of even using language like the transfer of trauma from generation to generation. And, you know, I also told them that I'm trying to crank up the juice in what I do on understanding the stuff in myself better. So this is an open dialogue that I have with them. But, you know, they still have tones of voice that they use. And I say, gosh, you know, I'm 37 and that affects me. Like, what was that like when I was 4? That same tone of voice. You
Before
know?
It became kind of normalized.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
How did that impact you emotionally?
Right.
And kids will internalize that humiliation. Rather than to risk their caregivers not taking care of them, they'll agree with them or go along with it without fighting back.
Yeah. Like, say, subconsciously, I guess there must be something wrong with me.
Yeah,
I think I related that story.
To survive.
Sure.
Yeah. I hope there's nothing wrong with these people who are in charge of keeping me alive.
Yeah.
I hope they've got their act together.
Well, I better agree with them that I am, you know, not worthy in order to stay here.
Well, it's both of those. Yeah. Or it could be either one of those. Yeah, yeah.
It was interesting when I was about to go to Molly's house, my mom said it's going to be earthy. And I was like, I have no idea what that means. And I think I finally figured it out. They talk about emotions where we never talked about emotions. Yeah. That's what she meant by, and she was trying to prepare me in some kind of strange way. It's going to be earthy.
As opposed to cloudy or in the clouds?
Confusing. It's confusing for a child.
Yeah. When there's not a clear articulation of a vocabulary of emotions.
But it was a very different type of an environment there. They would talk all at the same time and laugh, and it was a much louder and much more confusing place. My house was a little bit more stoic, and I almost felt like when you were relaying that message about the person coming up to your house, that's how it kind of felt for me going to Molly's house.
Yeah.
Talking over each other. I can't concentrate.
Yeah. The second one, did a parent or other adult in the household often or very often push, grab, slap, or throw something at you, or ever hit you so hard that you had marks or were injured? That's a no for me.
Yeah, not for me either.
No for me.
All right. Anything to add about that question?
Well, you know, you mentioned your brother getting punished physically.
Yeah.
So obviously it's a bit of an arbitrary way that they've categorized these questions and they want to simplify it. So just take that into account. And I mean, this is just the beginnings of understanding the nature of trauma, you know, and it's kind of like a quick and easy way to assess the magnitude of the adverse experiences.
Sure. Absolutely. The third one, did an adult or other person at least 5 years older than you ever touch or fondle you or have you touch their body in a sexual way or attempt to actually have oral, anal, vaginal intercourse with you? That is fortunately a no for me.
No for me either.
No for me, but in the Body Keep Score, he came up with a stat in a psychology book. They estimated that 1 in 1 million people had this form of incest. And on the ACE score, I think it was more like 1 in 100. The general thinking was off by a factor of 10,000.
Yeah. And they were the people that were constructing, I think, was it the DSM? Or I'm not sure what publication they were using. But they also followed that up with saying that it's actually beneficial. If it does happen 1 in 1 million times, it's a beneficial thing. Like, that is just perverse, right? And so they're discounting so much of that that's crossing boundaries, and that is really, really disorienting for kids.
Yeah.
And I would think that would be the worst. Of the questions, if I had to choose one that I would not want to have happen, and unfortunately there are way too many people that this happens to. So to those people, I'm really sorry.
And it's not just the matter of the incident, you know. I mean, that's something that just keeps really hurting somebody, because then there's probably secret keeping. There's a tremendous amount of shame associated with that. I mean, I think a lot of these other ones have residual effects, but those are some particularly difficult ones there.
Yeah, the shame and the secrecy and essentially dishonesty and inauthenticity and not, you know, this encouragement to be vulnerable about things and to be transparent. So all those things get sacrificed.
And these people will continue to seek out abusive relationships until they could somehow heal what happened to them.
Yeah. To relive the trauma. Hopefully, you know, the managers, the firefighters, or whatever the parts of self that are trying to protect that exiled, traumatized self from more of that, they're trying to find ways to relive the trauma so that they can heal finally. As paradoxically as that sounds, if they're in a situation that is, again, reliving it in similar ways.
Well, what's interesting is that the most intense professional experience that I had from 2002 to 2004 was teaching at a campus at a boarding school that was almost entirely composed of kids who had been sexually abused. They were separated from the mainstream population of the school because they were really high risk. This was the place that I've told the story on the show a few times. If you turned your back on them as a staff, they would start screaming in unison, unsafe, unsafe. In other words, we are unsafe. They had been trained essentially by the environment, by the people working in the environment to do that. We are unsafe. We cannot be trusted. You know, I remember talking to the psychologist who ran the program, and you know, he said that it's almost like clockwork, what he told me. He said, if they were 7 and they were touched by a 12-year-old, when they got to pretty close to around the age of 12, they would find somebody pretty close to the age of 7, and they would replicate the abuse as a way, I guess, to normalize it, or to like, oh, this is just what people do, or a way to, he also, and this seemed more speculative to me, take control. At the time, it was impossible to understand. You know, I just said, okay, you're a psychologist. I'll take your word for it. I don't get that. But I think, you know, wanting that kind of helplessness and shame and, you know, wanting a way to become the abuser to gain that control, that makes more sense to me now. So I do have a lot of experience with that, fortunately, as an adult. It's also fortunate in a way that we can probably know a lot more about that today, even though, I mean, this research was certainly out there then. Than I can understand it better today than I could have understood it back then.
Yeah, and I think Steven Weinman in that book, I covered major parts of it, read on the show, in the trauma series, Power Under Trauma and Nonviolent Social Change. I think he understands the psychological dynamics in play in terms of the powerless rage mm-hmm. that happens, because when you're overpowered like that, when you're treated as an object to someone else's desires without checking in, them checking in with you to see if that's what you want or if, you know, what's going on with you, then you get essentially overpowered. And then there's rage that happens in response to that. You know, there's the sort of minimizing the significance of it. There's the shame, there's the secrecy, but there's also a lot of rage from that, because our inclination is to have autonomy. I mean, you've seen little toddlers assert, no, I don't want to do it anymore, or I don't want to listen to you, right? Or I hate this. You know, there's that need for autonomy and self-expression that's completely just stifled in that scenario. So then how do people relive this trauma? Well, they're the ones in power now. They can have a sense of empowerment. It's like the people that, you know, in schools where there's the bullies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And most people that have been traumatized don't like to see weakness, because they know what their experiences were when they were in that lower position physically and they were overpowered. So rather than to come to terms with the nature of that traumatic experience, they would rather suppress the person who is the weaker one so that they can feel empowered in some way.
Yeah, I mean, and that's like, I've seen bullying in situations where maybe the bully wasn't abused, right? But they just had so little control. I mean, just kids just treating each other poorly in school, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember asking, why are you doing this? And there's no, they don't have an answer. It's not even like,
it's all emotional.
Because he sucks, you know, and I'm better than him. It's nothing like that. It's just like, well, I guess if I really thought about it, this is me getting some control in life. Mm-hmm. And it's not, maybe not because they were even abused. It's just because the whole parent-child dynamic, even for teenagers, they have so little control over their own times and their own lives, their own decision-making. And like, yeah, if I can just find this kid who's a seventh grader and push him around a little bit. I mean, it's all unconscious, I think.
But yeah, it's the limbic system just taking over and not attuning to the needs of others and one's own needs to respect others. And I was thinking about maybe the anthropological view of this sexual molestation thing. They would say that, you know, it's culturally dependent, right? So if you look at ancient Greece, you know, where there was the use of boys for sexual activities, and that was totally normalized.
Mm.
And various tribes that have sex with children, where in that culture, it's no big deal, supposedly. It's normalized. But if you look at it from an objective perspective about the nature of human freedom, the nature of choice, and the nature of rights, you know, what do you have the right to do? Do you have the right to defend yourself from unwanted attacks or aggression? You know, and when that's stifled, no matter what the cultural context is, everyone pays a price, you know?
Yeah.
It can be normalized, but this evolution of humans to a more and more respectful condition with themselves and with others, I mean, that's basically destroyed in this process where boundaries are crossed in that way, where people aren't respected. And it doesn't set a healthy trend for anything. And obviously, this is a very specific example of where boundaries are crossed that's really detrimental for a person's well-being as they age. But you can take it all the way up to statism. Boundaries are crossed with the entire legal system of punishment. And people put in human cages for indefinite, arbitrary amounts of time. And people suffer as a result of coercion as a foundation in our civilization to supposedly get things done or to protect people or to create law and order, you know?
Right.
So all this stuff has a bearing on how we view the nature of what it is to be a human and have choice and have freedom and have respect.
Matt, anything else on that one before you move on?
Yeah, it's just these little people that are, and I think it was well put, Wes, just these little people that are trying to make sense of this world. And then all of a sudden this crazy thing is happening to them and their emotions are going nuts and they're told by their caregivers, no, this is normal, or they're supposed to normalize it, you know, and we're seeing here that it's not healthy.
Right.
And even though it was okay in a tribe or in an ancient society, those people can't help by being messed up later on.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the whole spanking argument, right? Oh, I turned out okay and I was spanked.
I've heard that, yep.
But you're advocating spanking, right? You're continuing the cycle.
Yeah.
So it makes it very difficult to break these dysfunctional cycles if we're involved in that normalization process.
Sure. And before we go into the next one, I wanted to provide, I think each of us can hopefully provide just this information, which might help build this out a little bit better for the people who are listening. I am the oldest of three children. I have two younger brothers. One is 3 years younger than me. One is 5 years younger than me. My parents were married for 5 years before I was born. They were divorced when I was 21. My younger brother was 18, and my youngest brother was 16.
How old were they when you were born, your parents?
My dad was 29. My mom was 28. So how about you, Matt?
Yeah, so I had one younger sister, 2 years younger. My parents were 30 and 31 when I was born. I grew up in California and, you know, went to public school, did well in school, basically. My dad had a genetic problem that I actually was tested for, and I tested negative, thankfully. And he was, you know, this strong athlete, musician, and was relegated to a wheelchair, and it was getting worse and worse, and he couldn't go to the bathroom anymore. And he took his life when I was 26. And, you know, he was starting down the path, you know, for many years before that. And, you know, I had a grandmother that had the same things called ataxia. And we just saw her wither away, and he was going down the same route. So that's my background.
Yeah, sorry for that. That's horrific. My father died early, too. I mean, he was 50 when he died of alcoholism, complications, cirrhosis, and kidney failure. But he, when he had me, he was 25, and I think my mom was 22. So fairly young, and they hadn't done that book, The Art of Self-Discovery.
Sure.
They hadn't really ventured into that realm. So I was an accident, an unplanned pregnancy. And I'm not sure what the stat is on that. Maybe upwards of 50% are not really planned. Yeah, they got divorced when I was 7. So my mom moved to Idaho. My dad moved down to Texas. And he had visitation, so I saw him kind of on vacations and stuff. And my mom remarried and had a couple more kids. When I was 10, my sister, half-sister was born. And then when I was 13, my little brother was born.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all out in Idaho. That's where the family system is, basically.
All right. I asked, I thought that would be good information to provide before this fourth question. Did you often or very often feel that no one in your family loved you or thought you were important or special, or your family didn't look out for each other, feel close to each other, or support each other? And I think I gave myself a 1 for this one, but I'm wondering if it's actually a 2 or a 1 for each part of that question. When I was 3 and I had a brother, and then I was 5 and I had 2 brothers, and I remember how the attention that there was, you know, the attention there was for me kind of disappeared. I remember kind of going through a period where this was really confusing. But the real one for me in this one is, yeah, I guess this is where parents fighting would be covered.
Yeah, you know? I think so. And this is from the child's point of view. Like, did you feel that this happened, that no one loved you?
I remember feeling like I was kind of a danger, getting the feeling that I was like a danger to my younger brother. And I remember we would do things together and he would get hurt. And this went on until I was probably like, I don't know, 6, 7 years old. Like, I remember accidentally hitting him with a tennis racket or hitting him with a golf club. Like, you know, we were playing like a version of racquetball in the garage with tennis rackets. And he was maybe 5 and I was maybe 8. And I just, on a backhand, just hit him in the face. And I remember my mom's reaction to these things, because, and I've talked about this a little bit on the show, and, you know, she's a very different woman today than she was then, but she, as a younger woman, was either kind of distant or hysterical. And so she would come from being distant to this hysterical panic mode. And I remember that, like, affecting me really negative. Like, I did this. This was my fault. And a similar thing with a golf club. We were hitting acorns with a golf club one day, and one on the backswing, I just caught him, like, in the ear. So, yeah, I broke my brother's nose, and I was reminded of that, you know, several times, that I was made to feel kind of like a danger. So that it's interesting to think about the way the question is worded. No one loved you or thought that you were important or special. I mean, I felt like I was dangerous, you know, and that's not a very loving feeling.
No.
You know, the other part of that, yeah, waking up when you're 8 or 9 years old and hearing your dad screaming at your mom, that's definitely not feeling like people are supporting each other.
That they're close to each other, that they support each other, yeah.
Absolutely.
That they look out for each other.
Yeah.
And that even that you're important. I mean, I experienced a lot of that in my early years, where parents were just really high level volume arguing and just losing it, you know? Just their limbic systems were just on hyperdrive.
Yeah.
And not able to make sense of what really mattered to them and what their behavior was about. You know, that's all part of the disconnection process. You know, when parents portray to children this kind of craziness, as you say, Matt, it's disorienting and confusing and just can be devastating to children, because they look to adults to make sense of the world. You know, that's the parents are the first model of what being a human on planet Earth is about. So there's a lot of significance to being in that role. And unfortunately, being in a role can also be problematic. You know, being a, quote, good parent versus, quote, a bad parent. Rosenberg is, and various other NVC trainers have pointed out that it can be problematic to see those roles, like just playing a role, rather than having a focus on the quality of the relationship with yourself, with your partner, with your children. Everyone has equal dignity. And the need for equality and mutuality and respect is met.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of a different paradigm than what we're used to in this culture.
Yeah, I think that's well put. I definitely played a role, and I knew how to play the game. And, you know, if I did well in sports and did decently in school, you know, I was let do what I needed to do. And, you know, I feel badly for my sister. She would try to fight against it, and she got a lot more yelling at her, you know, but I felt important, you know, and I felt like they were keeping, you know, that they were supporting me. But I was, you know, hearing Wes say, you know, it now feels like a role that I was playing. It felt like it was very conditional.
Yeah. Conditional worth, conditional acceptance. Absolutely.
Like that 24th question of Brandon's, mentioning the glory to the parents, right?
How about you, Wes?
For in terms of the roles,
yeah. And this, did they make you feel important or special, or did you feel supported?
No, I would say no. I was basically really introverted at that point. Like, I withdrew from kind of engaging. It seemed like to me, that's my perception now. And, you know, memories are interesting. The way Bessel van der Kolk talks about the nature of memories and traumatic experiences and how they can even be repressed. And there was a lot of controversy in, you know, his testimony over a trial that involved repressed memories from trauma. And I think he made a pretty solid case that traumatic memories can be repressed. We can tend to minimize even the experiences that we had. But I didn't sense a lot of, when there's not the focus on health and well-being psychologically, there's not going to be much support, because people aren't feeling resourceful. My parents were not feeling resourceful at all. And it was a disorienting experience. And I wanted to make sense of the human world, but it was very difficult to do that. And I guess I didn't really acquire a coherent view until I got out of college, even, you know, because it's like you go into the school system and everything supposedly is figured out and you're just supposed to learn these subjects and go in this profession. and do all this, and everybody's acting as if they've got things figured out, but they don't. And there's massive pretense going on in the human world, you know? And I discovered this as I read Ayn Rand's works. You know, she's pretty iconoclastic on many levels. And it just opened my eyes to so much. If you read John Galt's speech, you know, we've talked about that, Brett, the redeem your mind from the hawk shops of authority.
Right.
And yeah, there's a lot of hawk shops out there. And parents, you know, when they get in the role as an authority, then you can surrender a bit of your own ability to make sense of things.
Right.
And so, yeah, I was in basically self-protection mode at that point. It didn't lead me to any sort of real costly strategies, you know. I dabbled in alcohol in high school, a few parties, but I was on the end of the continuum as opposed to some of my friends. I was more the studious student. I was in the honor society in high school, taking Latin and calculus and all that stuff. But yeah. I thought humans kind of had it figured out, but I had this sense of like, I want to understand the nature of human emotion. I can't really make sense of my emotions in the midst of all of these systems, you know, that aren't really being pointed out. Like there's all these elephants in the room and it's as if they're not there.
How did your parents react to your studiousness and taking Latin and all that?
I think they commended me. Yeah. Yeah. They were proud of me in that regard. Yeah. So, I mean, I did get that sort of support, but it's within a paradigm that is not so authentic.
Conditional support for...
Yeah, if I'd ever been flunking out or something, there, mm-hmm. I don't know how they would have reacted to that. Mm-hmm. But I just remember my dad telling me, you know, when I was in college, first year, he's like, I'm really proud of your accomplishments. And I didn't really feel like I accomplished much at that point. But, yeah, I mean, he was able to articulate that, yeah. You know, 5 years before he died. Mm.
I can relate to that a little bit. I felt like the way that I would get approval from my mother, the only way that I ever figured out is I had to be kind of funny. You know, I had to be amusing. I had to make her laugh. Mm-hmm. With my dad, I never really cracked that. Like, you know, I don't remember him ever saying that was, I'm proud of you, or that was great, or I probably heard things like good job, mm-hmm. you know, versus bad job.
Yeah.
You know, but that was, I think, as close as he ever got, you know. And, you know, you spoke to that a little bit too, that there's, I guess those were my roles, back to your original question, right? Like the role as in seeking approval and seeking the sense of a belonging. With one parent, I knew how to do it. With the other, I never really figured it out.
Yeah, I think I mentioned as we did our show, that last one, 212, episode 212, talking about dogs. You know, I remember having lots of dogs around me, and I'd actually drink out of the dog dish, right? And I'd eat dog food. And I'd eat those Milk-Bone dog biscuits. They're not bad, as far as I can remember.
You many had decades to, ago. Or why did you do this?
I did this because I guess I bonded more with the canines.
Oh, yeah.
Like I understood them more than the human chaos, right?
Right.
And they were always gentle and loving and friendly and fun, you know.
Yeah, I don't sense a lot of fun in your household.
Yeah. There was just a lot of fighting, you know, that was the issue. Dogs can bring a lot of fun, even to fighting couples. Like I remember my parents having fun with the dogs. Like mm-hmm. they'd go on field trials too, like take the dogs out and train them and win, you know, ribbons for their abilities out in the field. They were all hunting dogs basically. So there's lots of fun to be had, and it kind of opens up. To this day, my mom really loves dogs. You know, she's really sentimental about them. We've got like a graveyard of dogs above our house, you know, because dogs' lifespan, these dogs usually live 12 years, and some of them have died prematurely and all that. And it's really a sad thing when the dog dies, you know. It's been part of the family all these years, and you get the new ones, right? You replace these dogs with new ones.
Did you feel that the dogs may have gotten more positive emotional support from your parents than you did?
Probably, at times, yeah. And I think that's a common thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where parents tend to bond and show more affection to the animals, the other animals, or animals too, than the kids sometimes. And you hear a lot of people in this culture talk about hating humans but liking animals, you know, having more thoughts for animals. because humans can do all these horrendous things and harm us deliberately, you know?
Yeah.
Appreciate the questions. I mean, yeah. It's all about human connection and what kind of model of human connection do we get when we're children.
And what our strategies are as little kids. You know, we got to do something to get attention. We got to do something to get our caregivers to want to raise us. It's a survival instinct that we had. What are we going to do? We'll do anything. Mm. You know, some kids will do anything to get the attention of our caregivers.
Whether it's obey or rebel, right? I was tending to obey
most of the
time. My sister
went the other way. She fought against it and got a lot of negative attention, but negative attention is still attention.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my youngest brother at a very, very young age doing like a lot of what I would describe as daredevil activities. Like he would go out of, you know, like the dormers. So like windows that come out of the roof, if people can picture this. And he would climb out of a dormer window and walk along the top of the roof until he got someone's attention when he was like 6 or 7. He would climb tree like impossibly high trees. And I remember this, it was about 16 when this happened. He was 11. He was, there was this giant old tree out by this field we had, and it was like kind of near the road. He was hanging out in this tree, like 40 feet up in this tree. So 9, 10, 11 years old, somewhere around there. And he started, he created this pulley system where he was hauling junk up into the tree. You know, so he had like a bench up there, like anything that he could find that he could pull himself up into the tree, he would pull up into the tree. So we had this tree out in our yard next to the road, and you know, my parents were kind of dismayed by this because all the neighbors could see this tree filled with trash that my brother had hauled up there. And I remember that one day I came home and I saw just all of the stuff from the tree, like in the road. The tree had fallen, you know. Unfortunately, he wasn't in it, but it was like one of the scariest things because all he would do was hang out in his tree, way up in his tree. And I remember coming home, the tree had fallen, and all this collection of junk was smashed all over the road.
So in a sense, the safe place that he constructed for himself wasn't safe anymore. Like spending more time in the tree as a safe haven, a getaway place, right?
Yeah.
Rather than seeing the family system as the safe place.
Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting just the different paths we took. But he, as the youngest, I think, was the most likely to feel neglected. You know, like I was watched over fairly closely. I mean, we were all the oldest, right? So I think we might have observed being watched over more closely, being scrutinized, being disciplined. At least that was the case with me. I remember looking at my middle brother and saying, why is he getting away with that? I mean, he dropped out of school and moved out of the house when he was 16 and got a job. He moved in with a girl when he was 16. I didn't ever feel like when I was 16, like when I was a struggling junior in high school, like if I had said, I'm really struggling. And I'm like, I don't think my parents would have said, well, you always have the option of, you know, dropping out, moving in with your girlfriend and getting a job. That wasn't on the table.
Stepping in the adult world, but full on.
Yeah, but they were like pretty supportive of him doing it just a few years after they dealt with me. So that was his way out of that system, mm-hmm. or having to be in that system every day. And for me, it was complete. You know, I wasn't seeking attention. I wanted to kind of isolate and hide, and I would play by myself. I remember getting like really into what I called fantasy baseball. We might have talked about this briefly in the self-esteem series, and this is definitely its own whole show.
I think I remember you had a conversation with Daryl, wasn't it?
Maybe, yeah. That's Darryl who it was. Yeah, Daryl and I talked about this, that I wanted to get so into my own world that I had to, you know, I'd go out and play baseball by myself because I couldn't get other people to play with me when I have baseball. I mean, we could once in a while, but not as much as I wanted to play. So I'd go out and run around by myself and just pretend it was a game. And then I started like making up my own players and making up, and then, okay, well, who do they play? So I made up another team, and I was keeping track of this stuff in notebooks, even down to like the heights and the weights of the people.
It's amazing.
And I was keeping stats. You know, this is like the time I was 9, 10, 11 years old. I created my own whole baseball world, And then like I would get a new interest and I would try to like, okay, well, how does this fit into this fictional world? And this went on until like I can remember the names of these people today. Like there is space rented out in my head to completely non-existent people.
Do you still have
and how tall they are and what their number was in baseball.
Their stats.
And they're batting.
Still have the notebooks?
That's a great question. That would be a really interesting thing to find. We moved out of the house that when my parents got divorced in, I think the year, I think it was finalized in 1999 because I was about a little over 21 when they sold the house. The house that we had lived in since 1980 was sold and it had accumulated, you know, 20 years of junk. So a lot of stuff probably disappeared at that point. I hid them. I would actually, we had a drop ceiling in our basement. We had a furnished basement, but there was a drop ceiling. So I remember like putting things up there, like notebooks with fantasies and certain video cassettes and cigarettes and bottles of booze would all go into the drop ceiling. Because who would start pounding around on a drop ceiling trying to find stuff up there? But I guess it was all discovered when we moved out of the house. So,
So this kind of fantasy world that you have, you couldn't share that with your parents? You didn't feel like you could share that with them?
I didn't hide it. Like, people made fun of me for being the kid who played baseball by himself, like in the neighborhood, like other neighborhood kids. And it wasn't like I was completely exiled. Like, we would get along and play together sometimes, and they would be like, do you know when Brett's not with us, he plays baseball by himself? Isn't that weird? And I remember feeling kind of like ashamed when I would get caught doing it, but I wasn't going to stop doing it. I liked it. It brought me some kind of joy. You know, and I mean, I was pretty invested in it too. You know, I mean, I was like $40-$50 worth of notebooks into this at one point. So it was hard to pull myself away. So, I mean, the truthful answer is, yeah, I think there was, I knew it was a weird thing to do, but I didn't know what else to do. You know, I mean, that was what I felt like I wanted to do.
Why did you think it was weird?
To openly engage in fantasy, maybe at an age where most kids don't do that. Like, if you're 4, you can say, look at me, I'm a dinosaur. Okay, that's fine. But if you're 10, you can't say, look at me, I'm playing a base. I'm in the major leagues playing a game. You know, so there was something like, I should have outgrown that, was the feeling.
Yeah, I mean, that's terrible. I mean, my son is half of his day is in, you know, what a great world it is to be able to have fun with things that you make up in your mind. You know, that's the most creative people are doing that, you know, and why should you feel like it's weird, or why should you feel like most of the kids don't want me to do this or don't like it or call you weird? You know, I mean, that's tough, I think.
Yeah. In school, it was even worse, right? Yeah. Because this went on to school and I mean, this goes back to the story I was telling before. You know, I'd be in this something like reading class in seventh grade, and I'm thinking, like, all these baseball players I'm inventing, they really need a stadium to play in, but I need to know what it looks like. But it should kind of look like my yard, so I don't have to, like, tax my imagination too much. So my yard looks like this, but then if it was a stadium, and I would draw. And I would figure out, like, architectural things and like, try to make it realistic, and then it would get ripped up. You know, so like that was an extra frustration there, but it went to school with me, and I wouldn't carry the notebooks with me because God forbid if I was like, you know, this was something I was still thinking about and like devoting imagination to in middle school.
Yeah. Talk about off task behavior, Brett.
Yeah, exactly. Imagination.
Well, I mean, you still have a lot of emotion behind it. Wes goes, oh, so you were doodling and you reacted pretty emotionally to that. You know, I mean, no, this is major architectural
stuff. I was playing
stuff.
The role of the teacher, you see.
Right.
No, but I mean, he's doodling. I mean, this is a big thing, you know, to squelch an imagination is a terrible thing. And again, when you're trying to find your way in the world and you go, well, I can't do this. This brings me a lot of happiness, but I can't do this. Like, that's confusing.
I can't let other people know about it, right? I can't share this with others.
And, you know, my son plays like that a lot. And I go, God, it's kind of weird. Wait a second. You know, why do I think it's weird? Well, it's not weird. You know, that's me. You know, what he's doing is perfectly natural. It's my issue. And, you know, I had a tough talk with myself on that because what he's doing is, and what you were doing are beautiful things. And, you know, it's still if I'm hearing you, it still think it still sounds like you're saying should and weird, and I would say come on over and take a look at what a free kid that's been unschooled looks like, and it looks a lot like what you look like.
I remember talking to a therapist when I was 21, and I was like really, really apprehensive about telling, and I had never explained it. Like I had been caught standing in my yard in a baseball uniform, like just waiting for a game. Sorry. But I had never explained what I was doing to anybody. And then I was 21 and I was seeing a therapist, and I remember just being like petrified of what is he going to think? I'm actually going to tell him what I was doing. And he was like, that's one of the coolest things I've ever heard. Yeah. Good for you. Yeah. That didn't, I didn't think that would be the response.
What about the story with Ben in baseball, or whatever that you said on my show?
Yeah, but Ben's a little different. So he goes, Dad, I think I want to play baseball. And I go, all right. I can't wait to see how this turns out. And Ben's really marches to his own drummer.
Yeah.
So he's in his uniform and they're, you know, practicing and they're doing their deal, and he's in the outfield and someone hits it. And I go, okay, Ben. And Ben is now lounging against the fence out in the back. And I go, Ben, get the ball. And he goes, Dad, I didn't hit the ball. He hit it. He could go get it.
How old is Ben?
He's 9 now. I think he was 6 then. So baseball lasted about, I don't know.
An inning.
3 weeks.
They didn't play by his rules.
Yeah.
Anything else on that one? I think we've been most thorough on.
You know, I think that one actually pertains to, like, if you're just to expand the nature of that one.
Yeah.
It goes into the branding questions pretty well.
The first one, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Number 5 on the ACE study.
Oh, the one. Survey. Oh, that we haven't done yet.
No, the one we just finished. 4. Actually, did you feel loved? Did you feel supported? Did you feel special or important?
Okay.
You treated that way.
Yeah. If you want to add some questions.
Yeah, that was number 4.
Yeah. If you want to.
But yeah, those questions that you kind of selected out from the discussions that Brandon was having with clients in Breaking Free initially, and then he put those questions separately in Honoring the Self. Which is more of a theoretical work, as well as the 6 pillars, I believe, too.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, those questions are really pertinent for what it means to be parented in a way that is enriching for the child's well-being, for their imagination, for their creativity, for their understanding of the world, you know, all the excitement. I mean, science is wonderful for that, obviously, and art as well, you know, to explore and to create. That's all part of that process of inner nurturing. I'm trying to find the questions that you plucked out of the 24.
Sure. Did you have any specific keywords in mind? I'm looking at them right now.
Well, we could go through just those ones that you selected.
Sure, sure.
Just quickly.
Absolutely. Of the 24 questions, the one I selected, the ones that I selected to relate to the ACEs were: when you were a child, did your parents' manner of behaving and dealing with you give you the impression that you were living in a world that was rational, predictable, and intelligible, or a world that was bewildering, contradictory, incomprehensible, and unknowable? Did you feel free to express your views openly without fear of punishment? Did your parents communicate their disapproval of your thoughts, desires, or behavior by means of humor, teasing, or sarcasm? Did you feel that you were psychologically visible to your parents? Did you feel real to them? Did your parents seem to make a genuine, thoughtful effort to understand you? Did your parents seem authentically interested in you as a person? Could you talk to your parents about issues of importance and receive interested? Meaningful understanding from them. Did you feel loved and valued by your parents in the sense that you experienced yourself as a source of pleasure to them? Or did you feel unwanted, perhaps a burden? Or did you feel hated? Or did you feel that you were simply an object of indifference? I'll read the last two and then we can go backward to wherever you guys like in that list. Did your parents encourage you in you a fear of the world or fear of other people? or were you encouraged to face the world with an attitude of relaxed, confident benevolence, or neither? Were you encouraged to be open in the expression of your emotions and desires, or were your parents' behavior and manner of treating you such as to make you fear emotional self-assertiveness and openness, or to regard it as inappropriate?
So mm-hmm. I think that's real interesting to compare and contrast those questions with the ACE questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those questions are a lot about, whereas the ACE, I'm not getting many ones, but almost all those I'd get some
sure
half or whatever, however he scores it. I think those are much more meaningful to me.
Yeah,
as someone who's not quite to ACE, but kind of before that, especially from an emotional standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I react to those questions.
Yeah, there's a lot of reflections on feelings. Mm-hmm. How are you feeling? Did you feel fear? And there's like the guilt and the fear are typically big ones in the family system. Kids can bear a lot of burdens, unspoken ones, you know?
Yeah.
So how to nurture the needs of children? That's kind of what it boils down to. And reflecting on the way you got nurtured or didn't as a child, I mean, that is really the recipe that gets played out in the parenting process, don't you think?
And how I communicated my trauma, it was a lot like Brett's younger brother, like in some risky behaviors. You know, I was a surfer, big wave surfer. Like I can remember almost dying under a wall of water.
Mm.
And we would just go back out. We would paddle out in the mornings when it was dark still. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so a lot of behaviors that I can't imagine my son doing right now. And I'm like, why did I do that? And I think a lot of it is, you know, you look for that thrill or something. You look for that. I didn't get any emotions in my house. So I was like, I think I was addicted to the thrill, or at least I felt somewhat alive.
So you could feel something. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
And I'm like, God, you know, and then, you know, driving cars fast, you know, trying to hook up with women and trying to do anything to get some emotional attachment somewhere mm-hmm. is kind of how that plays out. It's not so much in the ACE, but in a lot of Brandon's questions there, it definitely plays out. And that's what I was sensing when you were talking about your younger brother. Why is he up in this 40-foot tree, you know, doing these kinds of things? And, you know, your survival strategies as a child affects how you're going to be later on in your life.
Yeah. Putting the pieces of the puzzle together.
Yeah.
All right. Before we move on to five, that's the end of hour two.
Ah.
So we're going to pick up right where we left off in chapter 17 of The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk. I'm actually going to wind it back about 30 seconds. Now, the clips at the beginning of the show and the clips at the end of the show serve different purposes. Using the work of Pete Gerlach, we're looking at the origins of trauma and some of the wounds, that's the word he uses, that can show up as a result. Now, the excerpts from the end of the show, from The Body Keeps the Score, acknowledge much of what Pete Gerlach is discussing, but also talk more about solutions, self-integration, and self-leadership. Now, as far as The Body Keeps the Score is concerned, I actually just purchased the book, and I will have it read by the time we record the fourth installment in this series at the beginning of next week. So far, I have listened to two audiobook chapters that Wes provided, and I have to say that especially chapter 17 had a very, very significant impact on me. The lessons of that chapter really helped me rethink some of the most significant and difficult interpersonal conflicts that I've had in my life. The chapter provided many new insights that led to acceptance, understanding, closure, and peace. And that was pretty damn valuable. So even though at this point I'm only two chapters into The Body Keeps the Score, I highly recommend it.
But most survivors, including those who are functioning well, even brilliantly, in some aspects of their lives, face another even greater challenge: reconfiguring a brain-mind system that was constructed to cope with the worst. Just as we need to revisit traumatic memories in order to integrate them, we need to revisit the parts of ourselves that developed the defensive habits that helped us to survive. The mind is a mosaic. We all have
parts. Right now, a part of me feels like taking a nap. Another part wants to keep writing. Still feeling injured by an offensive email message, a part of me wants to hit reply on a stinging put-down, while a different part wants to shrug it off. Most people who know me have seen my intense, sincere, and irritable parts. Some have met the little snarling dog that lives inside me. My children reminisce about going on family vacations with my playful and adventurous parts. When you walk into the office in the morning and see the storm clouds over your boss's head, you know precisely what's coming. That angry part has a characteristic tone of voice, vocabulary, and body posture, so different from yesterday when you shared pictures of your kids. Parts are not just feelings, but distinct ways of being, with their own beliefs, agendas, and roles in the overall ecology of our lives. How well we get along with ourselves depends largely on our internal leadership skills, how well we listen to our different parts, make sure they feel taken care of, and keep them from sabotaging one another. Parts often come across as absolutes when in fact they represent only one element in a complex constellation of thoughts, emotions, and sensations. If Margaret shouts, "I hate you," in the middle of an argument, Joe probably thinks she despises him. And in that moment, Margaret might agree. But in fact, only a part of her is angry. And that part temporarily obscures her generous and affectionate feelings, which may well return when she sees the devastation on Joe's face. Every major school of psychology recognizes that people have sub-personalities and gives them different names. In 1890, William James wrote, "It must be admitted that the total possible consciousness may be split into parts which coexist but mutually ignore each other and share the objects of knowledge between them." Carl Jung wrote, "The psyche is a self-regulating system that maintains its equilibrium just as the body does. The natural state of the human psyche consists in a jostling together of its components and in their contradictory behavior. And the reconciliation of these opposites is a major problem. Thus, the adversary is none other than the other in me." Modern neuroscience has confirmed this notion of the mind as a kind of society. Michael Gazzaniga, who conducted pioneering split-brain research, concluded that the mind is composed of semi-autonomous functioning modules, each of which has a special role. In his book, The Social Brain, 1985, he writes, "But what of the idea that the self is not a unified being, and there may exist within us several realms of consciousness? From our split-brain studies, the new idea emerges that there are literally several selves, and they do not necessarily converse with each other internally." MIT scientist Marvin Minsky, a pioneer of artificial intelligence, declared, "The legend of the single self can only divert us from the target of that inquiry. It can make sense to think there exists inside your brain a society of different minds. Like members of a family, the different minds can work together to help each other, each still having its own mental experiences that the others never know about." Therapists who are trained to see people as complex human beings with multiple characteristics and potentialities can help them explore their system of inner parts and take care of the wounded facets of themselves. There are several such treatment approaches, including the structural dissociation model developed by my Dutch colleagues Onno van der Hart and Ellert Nijenhuis, and Atlanta-based Kathy Steele, that is widely practiced in Europe, and Richard Kluft's work in the United States. 20 years after working with Mary, I met Richard Schwartz, the developer of internal family systems therapy, known as IFS. It was through his work that Minsky's family metaphor truly came to life for me and offered a systematic way to work with the split-off parts that result from trauma. At the core of IFS is the notion that the mind of each of us is like a family in which the members have different levels of maturity, excitability, wisdom, and pain. The parts form a network or system in which change in any one part will affect all the others. The IFS model helped me realize that dissociation occurs on a continuum, In trauma, the self system breaks down, and parts of the self become polarized and go to war with one another. Self-loathing coexists and fights with grandiosity. Loving care with hatred, numbing and passivity with rage and aggression. These extreme parts bear the burden of the trauma. In IFS, a part is considered not just a passing emotional state or customary thought pattern, but a distinct mental system with its own history, abilities, needs, and worldview. Trauma injects parts with beliefs and emotions that hijack them out of their naturally valuable state. For example, we all have parts that are childlike and fun. When we are abused, these are the parts that are hurt the most, and they become frozen, carrying the pain, terror, and betrayal of abuse. This burden makes them toxic, parts of ourselves that we need to deny at all costs because they are locked away inside. IFS calls them the exiles. At this point, other parts organize to protect the internal family from the exiles. These protectors keep the toxic parts away, but in doing so, they take on some of the energy of the abuser. Critical and perfectionistic managers can make sure we never get close to anyone or drive us to be relentlessly productive. Another group of protectors, which IFS calls firefighters, are emergency responders, acting impulsively whenever an experience triggers an exiled emotion. Each split-off part holds different memories, beliefs, and physical sensations. Some hold the shame, others the rage, some the pleasure and excitement, another the intense loneliness or the abject compliance. These are all aspects of the abuse experience. The critical insight is that all these parts have a function: to protect the self from feeling the full terror of annihilation. Children who act out their pain rather than locking it down are often diagnosed with oppositional defiant behavior, attachment disorder, or conduct disorder. But these labels ignore the fact that rage and withdrawal are only facets of a whole range of desperate attempts at survival. Trying to control a child's behavior while failing to address the underlying issue, the abuse, leads to treatments that are ineffective at best and harmful at worst. As they grow up, their parts do not spontaneously integrate into a coherent personality, but continue to lead a relatively autonomous existence. Parts that are out may be entirely unaware of the other parts of the system. Most of the men I evaluated with regard to their childhood molestation by Catholic priests took anabolic steroids and spent an inordinate amount of time in the gym pumping iron. These compulsive bodybuilders lived in a masculine culture of sweat, football, and beer, where weakness and fear were carefully concealed. Only after they felt safe with me did I meet the terrified kids inside. Patients may also dislike the parts that are out, the parts that are angry, destructive, or critical. But IFS offers a framework for understanding them, and, also important, talking about them in a non-pathologizing way. Recognizing that each part is stuck with burdens from the past and respecting its function in the overall system makes it feel less threatening or overwhelming. As Schwartz states, "If one accepts the basic idea that people have an innate drive toward nurturing their own health, this implies that when people have chronic problems, something gets in the way of accessing inner resources. Recognizing this, the role of therapists is to collaborate rather than teach, confront, or fill holes in your psyche. The first step in this collaboration is to assure the internal system that all parts are welcome and that all of them, even those that are suicidal or destructive, were formed in an attempt to protect the self system, no matter how much they now seem to threaten it."
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please help us out by leaving a positive review on iTunes. If you were angered by the show, please help us out by leaving negative reviews everywhere. If you think this is an important message for students, for parents, or for the future of intellectual freedom, please consider supporting us at schoolsucksproject.com/AV. For $6 a month, you'll get access to hundreds of additional hours of content while helping us grow and spread this message further.